Good evening and welcome to the Independent News Hour. I'm John Tarleton, editor-in-chief of The Independent, New York City's lefty newspaper and website. You can find our beautiful April print edition in our red and white news boxes around the city and in more than 60 public libraries and other public venues. We're also online at independent.org, independent.org. We're also very active on Indie Twitter and Indie Instagram these days as well with our breaking news coverage, which we'll talk about more in a moment. My host, Amiga Garrett, is off today, and I am broadcasting from Star Bar in Bushwick, Brooklyn at 207 Star Street. Star Bar is an event space as well as a social gathering and watering hole, and the Independent has hosted a number of events at Star Bar over the last few years, and we've hosted several movie screenings here, and we're going to do another one tonight. We're going to be screening The Battle of Algiers at 6 p.m. here, and then we have an amazing panel discussion afterwards featuring Vijay Prashad, a writer who's written numerous books on anti-colonial movements of the 1960s and 70s in particular, and also analyze. He does a lot of brilliant analysis of anti-colonial movements up to the present day, including in Palestine. And our other guest here at Star Bar will be Elaine Moktepe. Elaine is a native New Yorker who went to France in the early 1950s and became involved in international solidarity work with the Algerian Revolutionary Movement, led by the National Liberation Front, and participated and served in the new government of Algeria after they ousted the French in 1962. So she has a lifetime of amazing experiences from her time in Algeria and elsewhere. So we're going to have those two amazing guests with us, and that discussion will be moderated by my colleague and Indie Associate Editor Amiga Gagarin. So certainly would encourage anyone who's free to do so and interested to come out here. Starbar's a wonderful space, and I think we're going to have a really amazing program tonight. And we're going to be talking a little later about this uprising of encampments, Gaza solidarity encampments at various campuses. It's been spreading around the country. It started here in New York last week at Columbia University, spread to the New School and NYU in the last couple of days. And so we'll have a little bit more about that and other topics. But right now I want to welcome Anna Noguera, one of the co-founders and co-owners of Star Bar, is joining us. Anna was also the original co-founder of The Independent. So there's a lot of great connections there. And Anna, welcome to WBAI Radio.
Hello, John, and hello, WBAI New York City. Good to be with you.
Indeed. It's really great to have you with us. And can you start by describing what Star Bar is and what it does and sort of the role it plays in the progressive and left ecosystem here in New York?
Sure. So Star Bar opened its doors in 2016. It was founded by me and McNair Scott. We are both longtime friends and rabble rousers, activists for the last 20 something years in New York City and around the world. And when our landlord approached us saying that he's building a new building, what would we like to do with it? We saw this as an incredible opportunity to create more space for social justice movements to have both, you know, inward facing meetings, conferences, workshops, but also public facing. We wanted to create a venue that provided movements with a public facing event space to talk about the issues they work on, to galvanize support, to fundraise, and to celebrate the work that they're doing and the victories that they achieve. So that was the idea behind Star Bar. And it was coupled with also wanting to create a safe space for people who are under 21 or maybe don't want to have, you know, drink or party necessarily. So we created Mayday Space as well, which is a community space around the corner from us that hosts workshops and community dinners and art making banner workshops and weekends for big protests and rallies. So the two are sister spaces that really try to serve the social justice movement space in New York City.
Right. And can you tell us the motto of Star Bar? What it means? Conspire, collaborate.
Conspire, create, and celebrate. So, you know, as an activist myself, I know that some of the best ideas came from late night talks with comrades over a burger and fries and a beer, and some incredible ideas and action events were started that way. So that was the idea for the Conspire. You know, you're sitting with a close group of friends and you're thinking about this issue is so important. How do we affect change around it? And so some of those ideas come from that. And then create, which is you need a space to create things, to create banners, to create even just public awareness, to create things, and then to celebrate. You know, so much of this work is hard. It's emotionally toiling. But when you have a victory or when you accomplish an incredible action, you want to celebrate with your friends and you want to build on that momentum. And ultimately, I think it was actually Juan Gonzalez who told me this a long time ago, and it stuck with me, that some of the most important things that come out of movements are relationships. And so we wanted to foster a space that nurtures relationships in from beginning to end.
Right. And they have more of these kind of spaces in some European countries as the kind of social movement centers, I think is the term. Is that part of the inspiration?
Absolutely. Actually, with a couple of the co-founders of Mayday Space, traveled to Spain to study some of their social movement spaces. Europe has a very rich social justice movement space ethos, and it's constant. And sometimes it's not even in a building or a room, it's on the street. So we definitely wanted to learn from them and nurture that experience. And it's harder to do in a place like New York City, with, you know, streets being very controlled and rents being very high. So it was a challenge here, and it continues to be a challenge, I think, for many places around the country. But absolutely, it's a model to work on.
Right. And you all have what I think is a wonderful model in terms of how you do open your space to all sorts of groups, including the independent, to host events, where you make the space available, and then Starbar makes its money off of what people spend on food and drink, essentially?
That's correct. I mean, we also do host other events that are maybe not social justice focused, and
okay,
they might pay a booking fee that helps cover the cost of a sound person and all the equipment and backline they may use. But we still, no matter what, across the board, try to keep it very affordable, just because we want to nurture art as well, and music and theater and puppetry. Some of our bartenders have hosted their own puppet shows at Starbar. So we want to, across the board, try to make it affordable, but also, of course, we need to pay the bills. That does mostly come from food and drink.
Amazing. And thinking of my friends here at WBAI, whether WBAI as a station wanted to, if they wanted to host an event at Starbar, or if people who, do different programs on WBAI wanted to host an event here, would that be possible? And how do people contact Starbar to get things rolling?
Of course, we'd love that. The easiest way is to email us at bookings@starbar.com. You can email us directly, or even better, go to our website, starbar.com. That's with two R's. And there's a form there you can fill out, and that goes directly to me. I do all the bookings at Starbar. That goes directly to me, and I get back to you, and we can set a date and time. It's very simple.
Anna, I don't know if it's my headphones or if it's you, but can you speak a little louder?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, the easiest way is to go to starbar.com. Can you hear me? Are you
okay? And can you give us a sense in terms of the sort of range of events that happen at Starbar? Like the kind of groups, say, you've hosted over the past month here in April?
Sure. We host all kinds of events. We host, like tonight, an amazing film screening and panel discussion. Afterwards, there's going to be our resident DJ QC on the decks to provide some lovely R&B music for you all. So DJ parties, film screenings, comedy shows. You know, this weekend we're having a Spanish tenant tenant power mixer. So folks who work on tenant rights in Spanish communities are coming together to have a happy hour, followed by a showcase of Puerto Rico's most amazing new talented artists coming to New York and doing a big showcase at our space on Sunday. So we run the gamut. We do everything. I think most especially, you know, our very first fundraiser and event at Star Bar was for Standing Rock. And whatever the movement needs are at the time, we really put a lot of energy towards supporting them as much as possible. Since the October 7th attacks, we've hosted dozens of events around Palestine.
You're fading out a little bit, at least for me.
I'm sorry. Is that any better?
You were saying how Star Bar serves the needs of the moment.
Yeah, we try to support whatever's going on at the time as best we can. And over the last few months, we've hosted dozens of events around Palestine, discussions, fundraisers, film screenings, and even a breakdancing session that was for a fundraiser for a school that teaches dance in Gaza. So, everything from breakdancing to film and panel discussions, we've been hosting a ton of events around Palestine and are happy to do as much as we can. It's the role we can play in this gigantic movement.
Right. Great. Now you're coming back in a little stronger. So speaking of Palestine, I just want to pivot here a little bit. You co-directed an amazing documentary movie about the situation in Palestine / Israel that was released, I think, around 2012 or 13. And that came after you had been a correspondent with Democracy Now! For a number of years. Can you talk about this movie, Roadmap to Apartheid, which has sort of gained a second life since the October 7th and the war began in Gaza, and as people try to come to terms with what exactly is going on over there?
Absolutely. It actually pains me greatly that 12 years after the film came out, it is still relevant. But also it makes me proud that we were able to create a tool that helps people understand the context of what's going on. Can you hear me okay?
Pretty good, but if you can speak a little louder, that would be great.
Yeah. So it's, as you said, we worked on the film for 5 years and it was released in 2012. And we toured around both South Africa, Israel, Palestine, the United States, and some of Europe to show the film. And, you know, it's like I said, I'm proud that this movie still serves as a tool for folks to understand what's happening. It's just sad that it's still relevant. The film compares what's happening in Palestine with what happened in South Africa during the apartheid era. I am South African and my partner is Israeli. And when I was working for Democracy Now! In the early 2000s, we were covering the Second Intifada. And the more we were covering it, the more I understood what was going on there, the more I realized how similar it was to the apartheid system, which is not unique to South Africa. It's a crime under international law that could happen anywhere. And many organizations, human rights organizations, governments have since come forward and said, absolutely, this is an apartheid system. So our film really dives into that. How is it an apartheid system? What laws does Israel implement? What tools, what tactics, what military support it gets from the United States? All the different, many myriad comparisons there are to the apartheid regime in South Africa, as well as the movements that helped to take it down. So an analysis or a deep dive into the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement that was pivotal in ending the apartheid crime in South Africa is still going strong and growing every day with this latest genocide. So Yeah, since October 7th, the film has definitely gained a resurgence. We've been having screenings everywhere talking about it. And I'm, you know, on YouTube alone, we put a free link out to the film, and about 600,000 people have watched it in these last few months with comments saying, I had no idea. And now I know, and I cannot unknow. And I feel like that is the one silver lining of this whole thing, is that I think the world has finally woken up to Israel's intentions, and the crime against the Palestinian people.
Mm. And your thoughts on the encampments that have flowered in the last week on a number of college campuses, starting last Wednesday at Columbia University here in New York City.
It's incredible. And, you know, and not just the encampments, which are amazing shows of solidarity and bravery, but also the many calls for divestment that students have been able to generate out of their institutions. There's been so many recently that, you know, there's been Palestinian organizers calling for this for decades. And now it's an avalanche of it. And it's very promising and hopeful that these movements are gaining steam and making a huge difference. I know that after this call, I'm actually going to go to my local university campus where there's an encampment going on, at University Cal Poly. So yeah, it's incredible. It's spreading super far and wide.
Mm. And I mean, who knows how many of the people at the encampments maybe even watched that movie at some point and took something away from it.
I hope so.
I mean, when you make independent media, you always hope for that. You never know for sure. And speaking of independent media, since we have you here on the show, I mean, you've done many amazing things over the years. You've helped start different institutions here at Star Bar, the Mayday Space, both here in Bushwick. I mean, you're the first, what would you call it, video producer at Democracy Now! Starting in 2002. You did this documentary movie, and you also, played the foundational role in starting The Independent in 2000, following your experiences as editor of your college paper at SUNY Purchase up in Westchester County. And, I just think it's such a great story, kind of how your journalistic career got sidetracked a little bit when you fell afoul of your corporate media mentor who was displeased with some of the coverage you were doing at your campus paper. Can you share that story with people a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. Well, back in those days, we just started the journalism program at SUNY Purchase, and I was the editor-in-chief of its first student newspaper. And several of my colleagues and I were, you know, reporting on what mattered to students, which was police violence on campus or rapes or, you know, stories that, you know, don't necessarily shine a shining light on the campus. And the director of the journalism program was simultaneously the head of retentions on campus and student recruitment. So she was, she would take our discs literally on a Friday night and re-edit all the stories to be more pleasing, more less controversial, less, you know, less true. And so we had a big revolt, and she was my mentor, as you said, and we had a very frank one-on-one conversation where she said, well, this is how it is in the real world. Do you want a scholarship to the Columbia School of Journalism, or do you want to, you know, take your chances with independent media? And I said, choice is clear. So that's how that started. And I then immediately wrote a grant to the Puffin Foundation for $500, which I got. And that was the seed money for The Independent. And you joined right after that and has steered this incredible ship in the 20 plus years since. 25, has it been?
We're on year 24 right now.
24. Yeah. So it's really thanks to you for your stewardship of The Independent that it is as strong as it is today. But those were the humble beginnings.
Well, I mean, it's such an inspirational story, because I mean, so many journalists unfortunately make the other choice and become a part of the the machinery of our corporate media system. And I can only imagine, we're seeing the same situation on college campuses around the country right now, where the leadership of the colleges want the protests to go away and want the bad publicity to go away. So I hope there are still many student journalists who are facing this sort of situation right now that make the same kind of choices that you made, Anna. And obviously everything you've done since then has been amazing, and we're thrilled tonight to be able to be back at Star Bar hosting another movie screening and discussion here with the Battle of Algiers, and then our amazing panelists afterwards.
Thank you, John. I'm very happy that you are there, and I wish I could be there too. I have no doubt the bravery that these students are showing is phenomenal, and I have every faith in them that they are on the right course.
Right on. Okay, this was Anna Noguera, co-founder of Star Bar and so many other institutions here in New York. We'll be back with more after this short music break.
Desperate measures lead to death. From the mouth of Gabriel, who died in his sleep when the world was a very big mess, a very big mess. He saw too much. From now on, I will look away from every accident that come my way. Saw you were talking up above the aleph room, masquerading as a loon. Both of us saw things no one else would see as well. From the mouth of Gabriel, no one else would hear as well. From the mouth of Gabriel, from the mouth of Gabriel, from the mouth of Gabriel.
You are listening to the Independent News Hour on WBAI 99.5 FM. I'm your host today, John Tarleton, editor-in-chief of the Independent. I am broadcasting right now from Star Bar in Bushwick, Brooklyn. A little later tonight, we're going to be hosting the latest film screening in our movie series here at Star Bar. We're going to be screening The Battle of Algiers, the really epic incredible film about, just the brutal honesty of revolutionary warfare and liberation movements and how they fight colonialism. That was made in 1966 by Gillo Pontecorvo. And we're going to be screening that. And then we're going to have a panel discussion afterwards hosted by the Indies associate editor, Amba Gagarian, that will feature author Vijay Prashad, who's written a number of books about the anti-colonial movements of the 1960s and 70s, and also will be joined by Elaine Moktefi. She worked alongside the National Liberation Front in the 1950s and early 60s, and then later served in the revolutionary government in Algeria from 1962 to 74. This was a time where Algeria is really a magnet for revolutionaries from around the world, including the Black Panthers. Some of their leaders sought refuge in Algeria in the late 60s and early 70s, including Eldridge Cleaver, Kathleen Cleaver, and others. And Elaine works alongside all of these people, was a friend and collaborator, again, to, Black Panthers and members of various revolutionary movements from around Africa who came through Algeria in that era. And she wrote a book a few years ago about her experiences that was published by Verso. Elaine is 96 years old and she is still going strong, still incredibly lucid, has, you know, just lived almost a century of an amazing life. She now lives here in New York City. So we are so excited to have her joining us tonight at Star Bar. And if you want to come on out here, Star Bar is at 207 Star Street, just a half block from the Jefferson stop on the L train. You can hop on the L train at Union Square, or you can make your way via the G trains to the L train, depending where you're starting from. So Star Bar, you just heard from Anna Noguera, a co-founder and co-owner of Star Bar, about how this space plays is just an absolute incredible space for all sorts of social justice movements, to hold public events like the one we're doing tonight. So we're thrilled to be here at Star Bar. And we are hoping to bring, there is, if you give me one moment here, I'm flying solo here. Let's see. Okay. We are hoping to bring someone on. There is an emergency Seder happening outside of Chuck Schumer's home near Grand Army Plaza in Brooklyn. And we're hoping to bring somebody on from that and in a little while. But right now, I want to welcome a old friend of the, oh, not just an old friend of the Indy, but one of our key contributors for many years, Nicholas Powers. Nick, welcome back to the show.
Good to see you, John.
Yeah, it's good to have you back with us. And I mean, you're someone who's studied cinema a lot over the years, written about it some. Your thoughts on the Battle of Algiers is sort of a unique movie in the sort of pantheon of movies about revolutionary movements or politics.
Yeah, the two movies that had a huge influence on me for my left imagination and historical accuracy were the Battle of Chile, and the other one was the Battle of Algiers. And obviously the Battle of Chile is a documentary about the overthrow of the Allende government in Chile. And then the Battle of Algiers, although it's kind of drama fiction, right? That what I saw in that movie was, best way to put this, the impassioned commitment by an avant-garde revolutionary class that first had to take control of the streets. So actually, one of the earliest targets of the revolutionaries in the Battle of Algiers was the drug dealers and the drug users, the alcoholics, the pimps, the vice. And then once they seized control of the streets, because they knew that the criminal underworld was sometimes used by the colonial state as kind of a back door into the revolutionary movement, that they could be bought off and, you know, used to infiltrate the movement. So they kind of squashed that. The revolutionaries squashed the underworld, and then they moved on to start challenging the state. And the thing that came very clear to me in watching the Battle of Algiers, which always stayed with me, was that the reality of asymmetrical warfare for liberation demands that the oppressed use exactly the tools that the colonial state will then say are terrorist acts that are horrific, and that actually kind of use the means of resistance by the revolutionaries as a way of branding the revolutionaries as terrorists. And that they are almost like working in two different moral worlds. But there's a very deep hypocrisy, because the colonial state itself was enacting an incredible amount of violence every single day, whether it was the arresting, the sexual assault, the breaking down of people's homes, the murder of population, of the indigenous population, the colonized. And so it was, what it did is that the camera pulled back the lens and to show that this cycle of violence, this kind of quote unquote, like the terrorist violence of the revolutionaries against the colonial state wasn't coming out of a vacuum, but it was actually part of a cycle of violence. And that this cycle of violence was accelerating and accelerating, almost like one of those kind of atom smasher tubes in the Swiss Alps, the Hadron colliders. And it was spiraling and spiraling. And that eventually that the revolutionary violence would be able to leave the orbit of the colonial state. It would be able to smash the colonial state and found a new state with the true consent of the people. And so in some ways, I felt the Battle of Algiers was, to me, a template for what revolutionary change can look like. And then the last thing I'll say is that it's so odd because when I think about the Battle of Algiers, I think of how watered down versions of it have been in so many American movies that if you look at, you know, the Star Wars franchise, if you look at many of these Hollywood films, they have this kind of watered down revolutionary kind of superficial cartoon version of a revolution. Star Wars being the most obviously famous one. And it's so odd to see products by Hollywood promoting this idea of liberation and revolution, however watered down, however cartoonish, to a population that, and around the world, you know, when the U.S. itself is one of the most conservative, you know, imperialist states, oftentimes selling arms to right-wing dictatorships and propping up conservative regimes around the world. And so in some ways, like, you know, we are the empire, but yet it's like the empire is selling itself the image that it is actually the rebellion. And I just thought that there was an odd historical irony there. Oh, John, I can't hear you. Oh, John, I'm sorry. I can't hear you.
John, you need to unmute. You know, that button that usually requires you to be audible and have the listening audience hear every word you say. Okay, I think
what's going on right now here at Star Bar.
Okay, you worked it out. All right, all right.
All right. We're just having a live radio moment there. Have people coming by. I'm sorry, Nick. Yeah, I was starting to ask any last thoughts on just the aesthetics of the way Pontecorvo, the aesthetics of how that story is told.
Yeah, I mean, the film is obviously shot in black and white. It's shot in a kind of a semi-documentary style. In other words, that it doesn't use, I would say, a lot of the either new wave from French or Hitchcockian or surreal camera angles or images or film noir. In other words, it doesn't use any kind of stylized aesthetics that would draw attention more to the aesthetics. And what it does is it almost really seems to use the visual vocabulary of a documentary. And, you know, the camera work is very, very simple. And what drives the movie is the crackling energy of the performance by the lead, whose name, you know, eludes me right now, but he was a fantastic lead, a handsome man. You know, you could almost see the revolution burning like embers in his eyes. And then obviously what it shows is the main character really is actually the building of the revolution. And the protagonists and, you know, the other characters are in a sense almost like vehicles for the larger revolution. But what's odd is that it's not a didactic film, because the characters themselves also are saying that the revolution is the main character in their lives, that they're all in service to it. And then finally, often the soundtrack is just amazing. If anyone takes a moment to, even if you just close your eyes and listen to the soundtrack, it's one of the most propellant, you know, adrenaline-driven soundtracks that you can hear. And it perfectly matches the building tension as the revolutionaries shoot people of the police as they bomb buildings and as they basically wage a guerrilla, urban guerrilla war against the colonial state. And so the music just matches that. It's almost like listening to a heartbeat getting faster and faster. So yeah, the aesthetics of it are just, you know, top notch.
Right. We have a couple of clips, just changing gears here back to the encampments, the Gaza Solidarity encampments that have been popping up here in New York City at several campuses and across the country. We have a couple of clips that I think we I hope we can go to in the next minute or two. But your thoughts also as a professor out at SUNY Old Westbury. I don't think there's an encampment out there, but your thoughts on the students, at least at certainly some high-profile colleges, really saying that they have to speak out, and you know, regardless of whether their administration wants them to shut up or not.
Yeah, I almost want to start an encampment at SUNY Old Westbury myself. You know, as long as I can get Wi-Fi, so I can grade my papers, I'll be out there. But anyway, as a professor, seeing other professors specifically at Columbia, voice their opposition to the president, Columbia's president, who went in front of the Senate committee and just had a disastrous appearance, basically folded like a house of cards. And to see the professors out there in solidarity with the students to me was, just heartening. And it was a generous act of solidarity. I think what the students are doing is in the tradition of, you know, the 1968, the anti-apartheid movement, the Occupy movement, the Me Too movement, the BLM. And students have always been at the forefront of political and social change in the country, which is why colleges have always been considered the laboratories of democracy. Because the goal at colleges is to have free and open academic questioning that allows for young minds to question the dogma that they've inherited through, you know, earlier education. And in that, hopefully come up with new answers for the time that they're living in, rather than get stuck with old answers that are not going to move them forward.
Right. So I think we're going to hear now from students first at the New School. Our colleague Amber Gagarin was there on Sunday when they started their Gaza Solidarity encampment. And then we'll hear from NYU, where there was a rally this morning. Dozens of students and faculty were arrested last night, less than 24 hours after an encampment was set up there outside the Stern School of Business on West 4th Street. So let's hear from folks.
Columbia is not a lie.
Every person
has a people power.
Columbia is not a lie.
Columbia is not a lie.
My name is Jenna Muhammad. I go to the New School. I'm a second-year student studying global studies. And I'm also a member of SJP. I'm comms chair. Our demands, namely, divest from death. As I said, divest from all companies that are complicit, that are funding this genocide of Palestinians. And we also, in that demand, we also demand disclosure. We want to know where our money is going. You know, the school takes tens of thousands of dollars from students, and we absolutely have no sort of transparency to where our money's going. Our second demand is protection for pro-Palestinian students. A majority of our protesters have been charged through Title IX, through being anti-Semitic, or showing hostility towards Jewish students, including our student rabbi being charged for anti-Semitic remarks. And our third demand is academic boycott of the apartheid state. We reject any sort of normalization with the Zionist state of Israel. You know, we demand just a full academic boycott of cultural institutions. The school has a partnership with the Israeli Conservatory of Music, and it hosts Zionist students, not only Zionist students, but Zionist students that have enlisted in the IOS. I mean, NSJP had a call about forming our own encampment, and obviously we were inspired by Columbia's encampment, to kind of relay it on our campus as well, not only to show solidarity with them, but also, like, we're driven to completely divest. And if it means staying here, sleeping here, not moving, making noise, creating hostility, it will take anything. You know, RSJP is made up of, you know, it's very diverse, you know, and also stand in solidarity with NewsFu, who's trying to get recognized by...
the academic workers.
Yeah, the academic workers union. They're outside the thing. You know, SJP is not only committed to, you know, freeing Palestine or raising awareness about Palestine, but also Black solidarity, trans solidarity. And, you know, that's something we're also driven by.
Here, 75 years of colonization of Palestine, 75 years of ongoing Nakba,
right.
75 years of genocide,
right.
200 days of genocide accelerated in Gaza.
Yay. Yay.
While ethnic cleansing is taking across the West Bank as well,
Yay.
And they wage war on Lebanon and Syria and all places around the Middle East as an extension of empire.
Shame!
Why is NYU on that side?
Shame.
Because of who's on their board.
Shame.
Just for example, Larry Fink. Investor in at least five companies that are benefiting from the death and destruction and climate disaster that's taking place in Palestine.
Okay, so yes, that you just heard student activists at the New School, where they still have an encampment going at their main campus building, and then also you heard a speaker from NYU. Where the encampment was dismantled last night, and dozens of students and faculty and community members were hauled away on NYPD buses. I've been talking with the Independent's contributing editor Nicholas Powers about some of this, but also I now have a special guest alongside me here at Star Bar, and that is and you're For those who just tuned in, you're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM, and this is the Independent News Hour. I'm your host, John Tarleton, and I am here at Star Bar in Bushwick, Brooklyn, where we have a big event tonight, a movie screening and panel discussion. And I now have alongside of me Elaine Moktefi. She's going to be one of the panelists talking tonight after we screen the Battle of Algiers. She served in the revolutionary government in Algeria after that country gained independence in 1962. Elaine, welcome to the Independent News Hour.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thank you very much for having me. I've been asked to introduce myself. Well, my name is Elaine Moktefi, and I guess the most essential thing that I should tell you is that I worked for the National Liberation Front during the Algerian War, which went on from 1954 to 1962, in their New York office. We were attempting to pass a resolution by the United Nations in favor of Algerian independence. It was a very long war. And it took 6 years of that war for us to finally get that resolution passed through the United Nations. One of the outstanding refusals was that of the United States, which finally stepped aside from France's government and withstayed from approving or disapproving in the finally after 6 years.
Right. And we're going to have another guest calling in here, joining us in a minute, but you've been going to these encampments, or the encampment over at Columbia. You live near there.
I've been going over to Columbia practically every day, and chanting with the onlookers who are students and also people from the community in support of Palestine in opposition to this genocide that's taking place at the present moment. It's been so supportive that students have promised to stick with it. They've become so engaged, and everyone who goes to these protests feels so engaged. And we feel so definitely that the United States is terribly involved and should withdraw immediately, but this is not happening.
Still got a little ways to go on that one, but there's definitely no doubt there's more questioning in opposition to Israel and its apartheid state than any time, I think, since it was founded in 1948. And I think right now we're going to be able to go to Sophie Elman Golan, from the Jews for Racial and Economic Justice. They're one of a number of groups that's holding an emergency Seder outside of the home of Chuck Schumer in Brooklyn. Sophie, are you there?
Yeah, hi, I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Yes. So we have a few more minutes left in the show today. Can you tell us, can you kind of paint the scene of what's going on out there with the emergency Seder and why you all are doing this?
Yeah, we're prepared to hold a Seder ritual tonight outside in Grand Army Plaza right by Senator Schumer's home, calling, you know, for an end to the arming of Israel as it bombs Gaza and, you know, continues to support settlers terrorizing Palestinians in the West Bank. You know, I believe the vote has not yet happened yet, but regardless of what happens, you know, we're gathering as thousands of American Jews on the second night of Passover and on the doorstep of Senator Schumer to demand an end to this, the U.S. funding and arming the Israeli military as it enacts genocidal violence. So we'll be gathering together. You know, this is a holiday of, this is supposed to be the Jewish holiday of liberation, but never again means never again for anyone. And we cannot, you know, celebrate liberation when in our name such violent oppression, is is being carried out in our name and with our tax dollars.
Right. And for people who aren't totally familiar with the Passover story, the liberation story, can you just outline that and why you think that points toward solidarity with the Palestinians in this time?
Yeah, this is the, you know, the Passover story is the biblical Exodus story of, you know, the Jewish people or the Hebrews, as, you know, they're called, or Israelites, you know, being enslaved in Egypt and being liberated through, you know, essentially a series of miracles brought on by God through the prophet Moses. And you know, the people are able to escape out of Mitzrayim, which translates to the narrow place, out of enslavement and into liberation and freedom. And it feels, you know, ironic that we are recalling the story of an Exodus where, you know, the Hebrew slaves, you know, left Egypt, fled Egypt in search of freedom, when right now so many Palestinians are actually desperately trying to get into Egypt in order to stay alive. And of course, when forced to flee, are doing so without even knowing if they'll be able to return to their homes. So it feels extremely important for us that we come together today and we, you know, continue to say that we are acting right now, speaking out as Jews and speaking out for Palestinians, you know, not in spite of our Jewish values, but because of them and with our Jewish ritual. There is a
right.
part of the Seder that involves them. It's called Shulchan Arech, and it's a sort of celebratory meal, and we'll be forgoing that tonight because we don't feel that we can, at this gathering, we don't feel that we want to be holding a celebratory meal outside of Senator Schumer's home while we're calling on him to end U.S. funding for the Israeli military's violence against Palestinians.
Right. And I'm sure you're following all the news from the encampments, including the one at Columbia, which has sort of been the focal point of a lot of media attention. Sophie, you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Tremendous media attention at Columbia. And certainly there's been this narrative in the right-wing press and a lot of, in corporate outlets, that Jewish safety has been endangered. The Jewish students at Columbia and other campuses are in danger from these encampments. Your thought of the way Jewish safety is being framed here in terms of demands to shut down these encampments?
Yeah, I mean,
we have about one more minute.
Sure. We fully reject the right-wing characterization of our movements as inevitably hostile or permanently hostile towards us as Jews. You know, the people who have lined up to frame this as an issue of Jewish safety are, of course, saying nothing about the safety of Jewish students who were arrested by the NYPD. They've made, you know, these photo op visits to Columbia as if it is a war zone. But we, of course, know where the real war zone is, and it is in Gaza. And, you know, we reject any kind of idea that positions Jewish safety as in conflict with free speech and with our, you know, our progressive movements and our values. So we reject that narrative. You know, Jewish students have been speaking out saying that they reject it as well. Certainly all Jews should feel safe and respected in our Jewish identity. And there will always be people who will try to inject hateful message into public action. But we know that those are disproportionately amplified as representatives by those who oppose and want to fear the movement. And we're not going to be distracted from the thing that we're calling for, which is, of course, for the end of the U.S. military's support for the Israeli military's genocide against Palestinians.
Okay. Well, Sophie, we thank you so much for joining us today on the Independent News Hour. And we wish you all the best with this emergency Seder outside of Senator Schumer's home tonight. And that's going to be it for this week's show. I'm John Tarleton here at the Star Bar, where we're going to have a film screening and movie and discussion afterwards for anybody who wants to join us. I want to thank our board operator, Reggie Johnson, as always. Also, my colleague, Amba Gagarin, helped out behind the scenes. And we'll be back in the coming weeks with more shows. Thank you. We have some outgoing music for you.